Get energized and excited to tell the world, hey, you can call me Catholic. Live from the Christ Cathedral Campus in Garden Grove, California, EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network and Orange County Catholic Radio present Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normandin.
Whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is gracious, if there is any excellence and if there is anything worthy of praise, well, what are you waiting for? Let's talk about these things. These are the words of St. Paul, more or less, and it stands to reason we should talk about them too. Makes sense to me, especially since we are on radio and you couldn't hear me thinking. So we're going to talk about them. That is certainly what we do on Call Me Catholic. I'm Peggy Normandin, and you have arrived at Call Me Catholic, a light and lively hour of conversation intended to affirm, explore, and celebrate our Catholic identity in these modern times so we can wake up and say to the world each and every day, oh yeah, you can call me Catholic. Jimmy G, my ridiculously capable engineer and chief fact checker, is sitting across the desk from me. Now I'm going to be honest with you folks. I don't think Jimmy G does a lot of fact checking. Do you? Fess up here, Jimmy G.
Más o menos.
Good cop out when you answer me in Spanish.
Well, we were just talking about St. Paul, more or less, and so, you know,
Well, in fact, because it's almost baseball season, you're probably doing a lot during the show. If I looked at your screen over there, you'd probably be doing the fact checking on all of the spring training teams.
Most of the fact checking I do has to do with mixing audio sounds, making sure that the music sounds good, and that's the kind of fact checking I'm good at.
You're keeping it real in the technical department. No, I'm just teasing you. I like to call you my fact checker, because you're a very bright man.
You made that up, fact checker. I did not make that up.
I added that to your business credentials.
Yes.
No, I mean, he keeps me honest, folks, and I like that. That's why I got him across the desk. So Jimmy G and I are coming to you from high atop the Tower of Hope on the beautiful Christ Cathedral campus in Orange County, California. This is the great Diocese of Orange between Los Angeles and San Diego. I always like to say that to remind our old listeners and our new listeners exactly where we are geographically. There is always something going on this fantastic campus that we have that is the headquarters of our diocese. It's 34 acres. It has many buildings, many beautiful facilities. And as it's grown and matured, it continues to offer so much for the great congregants of the Diocese of Orange. I noticed they've got a book club coming up now for the diocese.
That's right.
Books that Bishop Vann is selecting every quarter. So everybody reads them. They come every 3 months and meet the author and hear the commentary. I think that's brilliant. I noticed also, to celebrate St. Patrick's Day this coming week, they're having open mic night at the atrium across the way there. And I guess you bring your talents, whether you sing or dance or tell jokes or play an instrument or tell a good story, you can come up and share it with the folks. I'm assuming this should all sort of be St. Patrick's Day themed. But any interest in going, Jimmy G? Any talents you'd like to share with an open mic?
Well, we're going to transition from being Diocese of Orange to Diocese of Green this week.
Land of Erin.
Yes.
Yes, I think it sounds like fun. So do you do anything to celebrate St. Patrick's Day? You've got green on today.
I kind of do through my kids, because the kids do at school. You know, they've got their little St. Patrick's Day things they do. So I probably get a shamrock shake. So, you know.
Not an Irish coffee.
For morning. Yeah, I'll do that for morning. Yeah.
Okay, so today on Call Me Catholic, we're going to get this party started and honor the good St. Patrick a wee bit early. Now, we're not putting any Irish in our coffee quite yet, but we are prone to shenanigans on Call Me Catholic, so you never know what to expect. Actually, we have a really bright and very interesting guest with us today whose book, The Sons of St. Patrick, has just been released by Ignatius Press. It's a really fascinating study. It's a big book, but it's the history of the 10 archbishops of New York City, all of whom were either born in Ireland or are of Irish descent, all the way through to our current Cardinal Dolan. And this book explores the enormous impact and influence these Irishmen had on the city's formation right from the start and the history of Catholicism in the country. So he'll be up in a minute to dig into that rich storyline. And then in our Chatting with Catholics segment later on, I take my microphone to a second grade class at a Catholic elementary school here in the diocese. You know, I love those kids. And I ask the young students what they know about St. Patrick and the celebration of St. Patrick's Day on March 17th.
Their words are always inspiring.
Yes, and they're very bright. I think these Catholic schools do such a great job in the elementary school years. And you might be surprised how much knowledge they have on this holiday. Okay, but first up, it's our Call Me Catholic countdown, which this week will be my top five favorite ways that we can honor St. Patrick on his feast day. Now, once again, we have a holiday that's a national holiday. Everybody's going to get on board with it. But let's remember that it's a saint's feast day. So you're welcome, world. The Catholics bring you these great saints to celebrate, and sometimes you have too much fun with the celebration, and we forget to honor the person after whom the day is named.
And St. Patrick's Day is falling on a Friday in Lent, too. That's kind of interesting.
Sometimes I haven't looked this up yet, but sometimes we get a dispensation from abstaining from meat,
right,
which seems a little silly, so you could have corned beef.
Depends on your local bishop, I guess.
Yeah. Do you know what the reading is on our local diocese?
I do not know, but someone posted on Facebook somewhere in Wisconsin they're getting a special dispensation or something.
All right. Well, you know, I always go for the potatoes anyway, so I'm not worried about having to eat corned beef on Friday. Okay, so here they are. These are my top five favorite ways that we can actually honor St. Patrick, the man who's credited with starting the first St. Patrick's Day when he died back in the 400s.
The Call Me Catholic Countdown.
Thank you, Jimmy G, for keeping it jazzy. Okay, so number five, go to Mass. It's a very important saint's feast day. This saint changed the face of Ireland as we know it today. It was a pagan country. He brought the gospel to the Druids, and he made it a Catholic country through his incredible missionary work. And he preached the good news, and he brought the Eucharist and the sacraments to the people. And so I think we can honor him by going to Mass. This is exactly what he'd want us to do.
Great idea.
To partake of the Eucharist and remember him and ask him to pray for us. Okay, number four, go out. You know, in a lot of the stores around this time of year, they have the little pots of shamrock clovers. The little clovers, the little three-leafed clover. Now, remember, this is the tool he used to teach the pagans what the Trinity was, three parts in one. So
right.
It's one clover, but it had three distinct parts. So go out and get a little pot of clover, put it in your windowsill. I don't think they're very expensive. And ponder on the mystery of the Holy Trinity. It's one of our great, beautiful, supernatural gifts in the church. And that is God in three persons.
Another great idea.
Yeah, nature.
You're two for two.
God, our creator, has buried a lot of beautiful lessons in nature. So we shouldn't take those things for granted or overlook them. Okay, my number three way. You know I'm a film buff. I love movies. So my favorite movie of all time is The Quiet Man. So I would encourage you to go out and rent this movie. It'll probably be playing somewhere on networks, the vast number of networks we have out there and cable channels. But anyway, this was one of John Ford's greatest masterpieces. It's all set in Ireland. It stars Maureen O'Hara, John Wayne, and it has a beautiful little Catholic theme in it too. Barry Fitzgerald plays the Catholic priest in the village. And I just love this movie. I have a big poster of it in my office, in my study. So it's beautiful. It celebrates the Irish, and it also celebrates the intrinsic life of the Catholic culture in Ireland, how intertwined they are. They also have a Protestant minister in the cast, played by Ward Bond, and they have a very cute relationship, the priest and the Protestant minister. So check it out. Quiet Man, it's a wonderful way. You know, you can go with the Darby O'Gill and the Little People, but, you know, that doesn't have the same Catholic resonance that this one does. So that's my recommendation. Okay, number two, why don't you go out and evangelize on St. Patrick's Day? You know, St. Patrick himself was a brilliant, persuasive, zealous evangelizer. And I think when we have a day like St. Patrick's Day, it's really easy. You don't have to stand on a corner with John 3:16 poster, but you can just, when somebody's wearing the green or celebrating St. Patrick's Day, or you're going to a party, just say, hey, do you know the story of St. Patrick? And let them know who he actually was. I think that would be a fabulous way to perpetuate his good and holy legacy, and also teach our neighbors, our friends, even family members, children especially, about the story of St. Patrick. Okay, so the number one way that I think that we can honor St. Patrick on his feast day on March 17th is to read the complete prayer attributed to St. Patrick. It's called St. Patrick's Breastplate. It's a lovely, long prayer that, according to tradition, he wrote in about 433 AD for divine protection. He wrote this so that he would receive divine protection before he attempted to convert the king of Ireland at the time and his subjects from paganism to Christianity. And he was successful, by the way. It's quite a long prayer, but a lot of times it starts, this is how it starts. I arise today through a mighty strength, the invocation of the Trinity, through belief in the threeness, through confession of the oneness of the creator of creation. So it goes on, and the very famous part says, Christ before me, Christ with me, Christ behind me, Christ in me. And this is all part of the breastplate.
Right.
So take a moment to read the complete prayer. It's quite beautiful, and it might might become one of your staple prayers. It certainly is one of mine. I absolutely love it. So you see, there's a lot more to St. Patrick's Day than green beer and leprechauns. So I suggest we honor the good St. Patrick on this day, and hopefully we're going to do him up right today and Call Me Catholic, giving him the respect that he deserves. Hey, you can give us a little respect if you feel generous or curious. Check out our Facebook page, facebook.com/callmecatholic. It's kind of a Call Me Catholic journal with notes and pictures from our shows and comments from our listeners like you. So join the family and give us a like, please. Hey, you're going to really like our guest today. George Marlin co-authored the book, The Sons of St. Patrick. It's about the 10 Irish archbishops who have governed the Catholics of New York since we showed up there well before the American Revolution. It's a fascinating history with an Irish perspective, so stay with us for that conversation. We're celebrating St. Patrick's Day today on Call Me Catholic, so get your Irish on. We'll be right back. I'm Peggy Normandin, and you're listening to Call Me Catholic on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Celebrating, exploring, and restoring our Catholic identity. This is Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normandin.
Hello there, lads and lassies. We are celebrating St. Patrick's Day a tad bit early today because we won't be with you on March 17th, so I hope you're wearing the green. We have with us today one of the great modern minds and authors of the Catholic Church, Mr. George Marlin. George J. Marlin is chairman of Aid to the Church in Need USA, an agency under the guidance of the Pope. He is the former director of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. That's a big job. And he's an extremely prolific author with 13 titles to his credit, including The American Catholic Voter, 200 Years of Political Impact. And we are anxious to talk with him today about his most recent work, which he co-authored with his colleague Brad Miner. It is entitled The Sons of St. Patrick. Ah, there's the thematic connection for the day. It's a fascinating study of the 10 archbishops, all of Irish descent, that have governed New York City Catholics since we first had presence on the island. George Miner, welcome to Call Me Catholic.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hey, you have managed to combine in this brilliant book my two favorite subjects, Catholicism and New York. It's the perfect love affair for me.
Well, having served in public life as head of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which included being the landlord of the World Trade Center, I ran for mayor of New York in 1993, but I had the privilege of knowing the last four archbishops in New York, worked with very closely with the late Cardinal O'Connor fighting the culture war battles of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a political junkie, number one, as sort of I've written several books on New York politics, the Archbishop of New York, historically, the last 200 years, has played a central role in New York City and New York State government. And people like the first Archbishop, John Hughes, Cardinal Spellman, also have been major players on the national scene, and in the case of Spellman, on the international scene. So,
right. Your book is a big, comprehensive historical account of New York Catholicism, but can you set the stage for us? So Catholics had a really dubious presence in early America. Can you set that stage for us?
To look at it particularly during the history of the diocese and the archdiocese of New York, the anti-Catholicism of New York was extraordinarily huge. You have to remember, until 1784, when a state law was repealed, it was illegal for a priest to reside in the state of New York.
Mm.
John Jay, first Chief Justice of the United States, a New Yorker, was a raving anti-Catholic. He even wanted anti-Catholic language to be put into the New York State Constitution when it was first drafted, right after the American Revolution. That was defeated. So you had this anti-Catholicism, and the first great Archbishop John Hughes, known as Dagger John Hughes, because they portrayed that little cross, a bishop, when he signed his name before his name as a dagger that was aimed at the throat of the anti-Catholics. But in the 1840s, when you had the great Know-Nothing movement and the original, prior to that, the anti-Masonic movement, which was really an anti-Catholic movement, a lot of it centered in New York. And in the 1840s, when many churches were being burnt in Philadelphia, Archbishop John Hughes went to the mayor of New York, who was an anti-Catholic mayor, and said, here's the deal. If one Catholic church burns in New York, New York City will look like Moscow in 1812 when Napoleon left Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
That scared the daylights out of the anti-Catholic crowd, and peace sort of came about within the city of New York. So Hughes was not afraid to be a bomb thrower. He's not afraid to pick a fight. And the great fight in those days was the anti-Catholics, particularly when it came to educating Catholic kids. He began the Catholic educational system,
yeah,
which became the model for the nation. So
no, John,
he was one of many archbishop that had to deal with this great anti-Catholic problem in New York.
Well, what I found his whole profile to be the most fascinating and enlightening and full of surprises for me, because John Hughes, his own background was he was born in an English-governed Ireland with no rights. Priests couldn't even enter the cemetery where his sister was buried. And he comes to America for religious freedom. And what is he? Ironically, he's facing the same kind of bigotry and abuse here in the United States, too.
Well, it was an Anglo-Saxon world at the time. And when the Irish population started coming in during the famine in great numbers, and as they began to get voting power in particular, the old Anglo-Saxon establishment resented this and looked upon them as jerks to start off with, particularly the Irish. And they were taking over the political establishment, and they resented it. And then there were these waves where they let really the uneducated go loose in terms of trying to destroy Catholic neighborhoods, burn homes. Even during the Civil War, the draft was geared towards
the Irish boys.
Districts, mm-hmm. where the numbers were greater from there. And, of course, the Anglo-Saxons were able to buy their way out of a draft by paying an Irishman $200. President Teddy Roosevelt's father, Theodore Roosevelt, and Franklin Roosevelt's father, James Roosevelt, both paid Irishmen $200 each to take their place in the draft.
Yeah.
So there was this resentment and constant battle. So it was a religious battle, a political battle. And the archbishops in New York are generally right in the middle of it.
Well, I could dedicate one whole show to each one of these archbishops, but I want to stay with John Hughes for just a few minutes, because I think what he did is quite amazing and awesome in terms of really turning that massive immigration that came with the Irish, especially during the potato famine, when we were just bombarded with the Irish Catholics. And interestingly, I think it was pointed out that a lot of the more ambitious Irish Catholics moved on into the Midwest and into other parts of the country. The ones that didn't have that much ambition stayed there in New York. So it was Archbishop John Hughes that really helped to turn some of their bad habits around. He started the Catholic abstinence program to discourage them from drinking. He went and took care of the kids, 60,000 little kids on the street, Irish kids on the street with no place to go, no education. And he did it with both tangible methods of feeding them, but he also really helped them learn their religion, too.
Well, he did that. First of all, you got to remember, the first parish in New York was St. Peter's down on Berkeley Street in Lower Manhattan. It was paid for by the King of Spain. Because they figured the King of Spain figured someday we'll take over the Northeast and I want to have a church for my people to go to when we take control. So there wasn't much of a structure in New York. And so when you have this mad rush of Catholics coming in, the Irish, because of the laws in England, were uneducated and unskilled.
Mm-hmm.
So when the Germans came, they started coming in the 1850s in larger waves. They went to the Midwest. They were farmers by training and background. It was a whole different set of skills. So the Irish were geared towards the inner city. The only thing they knew how to do was get involved in politics because of the sheer numbers. So you're right, saw the problem and began to introduce, first of all, build more churches, get more Irish priests. Secondly, to begin an education system here, because the public school system was basically controlled by a Protestant society that called all the shots.
Mm-hmm.
He became friendly with Governor Seward, who was Protestant, and later became Secretary of State under Abraham Lincoln. And Seward worked with him to begin to allow Catholics at least to get some aid from the state. Some of the backfire laid on. Seward was thrown out of office because of these issues that the anti-Catholics went against him on. But again, he started an education system, started programs with some parishes, and started to meet the needs of the Irish immigrant and then other immigrants. But the parish became the center of life. And that structure lasts. I grew up for 17 years in the Catholic educational system in Brooklyn and Queens. That system he helped create lasted for over 100 years, where I, in the 50s, the parish was the center of my life. So you went to the dances there, you went to school there, mm-hmm. you played ball there. And that's what he started in order to maintain the Catholic identity and also help these very poor and educated people who came from Ireland. He was incredible. He did the incredible start that was built by his successors for the next 200 years.
We are talking with George J. Marlin, co-author of the book Sons of St. Patrick, A History of the Archbishops of New York City, who all happen to have been Irish-born or are of Irish descent. You know what I also love about this first Archbishop, John Hughes, is that the women that came in, the Irish Catholic women, the immigrant women, they didn't, a lot of them didn't didn't have ambition. They didn't have stability. And they were sort of seeking the lowest route for income and for sort of purpose. And he really stirred up this Marian devotion. He used Mary as this icon for female strength, for female dignity. And I love the fact that he took the tenets of our faith and he used them to kind of rehabilitate this culture of specifically Irish Catholics in New York City that were looking for some identity.
Well, they needed identity, they needed rehabilitation because in Ireland their religion was basically an underground religion. They couldn't learn how to read, they couldn't go to school. So you had, you know, they were nominally Catholics in a sense, but in terms of understanding the tenets of their faith and how those tenets worked in the public square, that's what Hughes was able to bring to the table. And again, that was built upon, you know, there was a number of waves of anti-Catholicism in the United States. It started during the Hughes period in the 1840s. In the 1890s, there was another great wave of anti-Catholicism. So during that era, the church began to build and have a presence and was required for the Archbishop of New York and archbishops elsewhere to become part of the public fabric, because if they did not, Catholics would have been just assigned to the dust heap of history, because the establishment, the Anglo-Saxon Protestant establishment, tried to keep them under wraps and keep them from voting, from becoming citizens. There were laws passed as early as during John Adams' time as president, where they tried to extend the number of years you had to be in this nation before you become a citizen, just to prevent the Catholics who were starting to come into the nation from having a political impact.
Well, and he also gave them a place that has become, I mean, they are so proud of this beautiful landmark that he began to build, which is St. Patrick's Cathedral, giving the Irish Catholics this great cathedral that really further affirmed their sense of purpose, their sense of dignity, their relationship with their faith. And that was a remarkable, daring encounter, I mean, endeavor.
Well, who would have thought it would have been on Fifth Avenue between 50th and 51st Street, which at the time was just farmland.
Yeah.
He began the construction of it. It stopped during the Civil War. But, again, keeping in mind that Abraham Lincoln, Secretary of State Seward, asked him to go to Europe to speak to some of the heads of state, Catholic heads of state, to try to keep them out from endorsing the South or supporting the South or recognizing the Confederate States of America. Abraham Lincoln also sent a letter to the Pope at the time asking that he get a red hat. He died before anything was acted on. That was, of course, the first archbishop in the United States to get a red hat was John McCluskey, who was born in Brooklyn. The first New Yorker to get a red hat, and the first American gets a red hat. So even though Baltimore was the prime see, it was New York that dominated the news. And again, the interesting thing I discovered in doing the research of this book is each archbishop in his own way fit his time. Hughes was a great bomb thrower. He started at St. Patrick's. When he died, the place was broke. John McCluskey was a much more low-key guy, you know, picked his shots when he had to fight them. But he wasn't a bomb thrower like Hughes. But he raised the money to complete the cathedral in 1879, began raising the money to build more and more parishes. So McCluskey was more low-key. The 10 years he was Archbishop of New York, but
he was more fiscally gifted, too, than John Hughes. Wasn't so well known for his fiscal sensibilities.
I was a very dear friend of John Cardinal O'Connor. I revered him. He fought the street battles. He took on Mario Cuomo. And I knew Mario Cuomo. I met him in 1970, being involved in Queens County politics. Mario, who was pretty smart, thought he'd get outsmart John O'Connor, and he never did. And when you read the sections of our chapter, it's a remarkable story when you tie it all together, the run-ins they had and how John O'Connor beat him at every turn.
Oh,
but
gosh.
John O'Connor, great man he was in the public square, was not much when it came to running his diocese in terms of money, etc. So it took a Cardinal Egan who came after him, who modeled himself after Cardinal McCluskey, much more low-key guy, not a bomb thrower, but fix the finances.
And I want to make sure that our listeners know when you talk about bomb throwing, you're speaking metaphorically. Hey, listen, we are going to continue this really, really interesting conversation after our break. And if you have any questions for our distinguished author, George Marlin, about his book on the Archbishops of New York, give us a call at 714-282-6034. That's 714-282-6034. Our call screener, Marvelous Matt, will take your questions and we'll relay them on the air, although we can't put you on the air today because our guest is on the air with us over the phone, so you'll have to just relay them to Matt. Okay, we are Call Me Catholic, and we will be right back after these messages from EWTN, the Global Catholic Radio Network.
helping you navigate the daily struggles and blessings of life. This is Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normandin.
Well, sure, Anne Bigora, I am your host, Peggy Normandin, and today on Call Me Catholic, in honor of the upcoming feast day of Good St. Patrick, we are discussing The Sons of St. Patrick, the latest work of our guest today, author George Marlin. The Sons of St. Patrick is a tremendous history book co-written with Brad Miner, exploring the influence of New York's 10 archbishops, all of whom were Irish-born or are of Irish descent. So, George Marlin, we've discussed who I consider to be the most fascinating in your collection of archbishop profiles, John Hughes. He had an immeasurable impact on the upbringing, I guess you'd call it upbringing, of the city's earliest Irish Catholics. In writing and researching these 10 men, did you find one personality or one biography that really resonated with you or even surprised you?
To build on what I said a little earlier, each one sort of fits their time.
Mm-hmm.
So you have, at the turn of the century, 20th century, Cardinal Farley becomes Archbishop of New York in 1903. He recognized then that you had a great influx of Italians coming in. So he began to build the Italian church in New York, the Italian parishes. There were 13 when he took over. There were 76 when he left. He started bringing in Italian priests, encouraging them to come to the United States. He picked his shots now and again. He fought Albany, the capital, when there was anti-Catholic legislation trying to take away the tax exemption from our church property. He sponsored the Catholic Encyclopedia. He founded, Cathedral College, the Junior College. Built up Dunwoody Seminary, so he was building in the infrastructure. Hayes follows him, something of a bureaucrat, but then again, he picked a shot. He took on the birth control advocate, Margaret Sanger, in the public square in New York. He fought the Klan. There was, believe it or not, in New York State, there was a great uprising of the Ku Klux Klan back in the 20s. In New York, it's happening down the South, naturally, but he took that on with Governor Al Smith, who was Catholic governor, was the first Catholic presidential
candidate, right.
And he defended Al Smith in the public square. So, again, each of them took their shots, but certainly the greatest and biggest name that Americans knew and had the greatest impact on the church in New York and across the nation and internationally was Francis Cardinal Spellman, who was Boston-born. He was very close to Eugenio Pacelli, the Secretary of State, spent years in Rome working with him at Pius XI. And when Pacelli became Pius XII, the New York was open, and he appointed his friend Bishop Spellman, who was an auxiliary then in Boston. So he was a Boston-born guy, but he could easily be called the Archbishop of the United States. He was a short, 5'5", balding, plump guy, not a great orator, but people, President Franklin Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, General Eisenhower, then President Eisenhower, heads of state, saw something great in this man. And as military archbishop during the war, he was hundreds of thousands of miles, not only working with the troops, the Catholic troops, but at one point, Franklin Roosevelt, in 1942, was able to get Spellman the ability to go through the enemy lines through Italy to go visit Pius XII. And interesting, because ostensibly he was there just to talk church matters, but, we'll take that with a grain of salt.
You can get away a lot with a collar on.
Yes, here during the war, but Spellman was the archbishop during the golden age of the church, in my judgment, in the United States, that post-World War II period that I grew up in, when the church mattered, when the archbishop of New York was called the power broker, as we call him, he was the power broker, the Madison Avenue residence was called the powerhouse, and presidents and governors and mayors and senators and congressmen wouldn't think twice about certain subjects without checking in with the Archbishop of New York. So he built the church that we knew in the post-World War II period. Scores of schools, scores of parishes. And internationally, when he spoke, people listened, and particularly anti-communism in the post-World War II, which was really a Catholic issue, that became a center focal point to Spellman as Archbishop and military Archbishop. Now, Harry Truman in 1948, at the Friendly Sons of St. Patrick's Dinner, which I'll be at next Friday, on Friday, March 17th, 4,000 men in tuxedos, drinking oil. Harry
sounds
Truman
like the Al Smith dinner, too.
This is all men, so it gets a little more boisterous. Okay? Mario Cuomo was booed out of the place many years ago.
Well, Daniel, he's a Patrick fine Catholic boy.
But at that dinner in 48, Harry Truman basically declared his campaign for re-election and came out blasting Henry Wallace, the progressive candidate, and put out his anti-Catholic, anti-communist credentials in front of a Catholic audience. Mm. So that's the kind of power Spelman had at that time. So it transcended the city of New York. It went nationally and internationally. Mm-hmm. So 28 years as Archbishop of New York, he had an extraordinary impact, not only on the church, on the Catholic people, but on the nation as a whole. So he was the huge exception to all the rules. It was just remarkable.
Okay.
That this guy was able to carry all those balls in the air.
Absolutely stunning, the responsibility and the influence and the impact these men have. But ironically, George Marlin, I want to point out that all the way, the first archbishops, let's say all the way through Spelman, had to deal or dealt, maybe because of their leadership, with this unprecedented growth of Catholics in New York. From that point on, the irony is that these archbishops, in more recent years, had to deal with the shrinking of the church's presence in the city.
Absolutely. We have seen several things came into play. Spelman died at the right moment in December of 1967. He just took a major defeat. In New York State, they saw in the state constitution what we call the Blaine Amendment, where Catholic schools cannot get any aid. There was a movement to repeal that, but it got sort of botched up in a lot of other things, bills on that ballot, and it went down. And Spelman put a big push for that. He filled up Madison Square Garden, had Fulton Sheen as Speaker, Bill Buckley, a host of others fighting for this. He lost. And that signified the end of the Spelman era. 1 month later, he was dead. Mm-hmm. Cardinal Cook becomes the Archbishop of New York. Very low-key, very optimistic. But he had the day he was installed, Martin Luther King was assassinated. 6 weeks later, Bobby Kennedy was assassinated and was laid out, the first layman to be laid state in St. Patrick's, and Al Smith died in 44. 6 weeks later, Umate Vite comes down. Mm-hmm. Cook was solid on doctrine, but the foundations were shaking within the church and, of course, within the city. The madness of the 60s, the Vietnam War, New York City going financially broke.
The culture is changing.
The culture is changing. And there was also a huge demographic change where the old blue-collar Catholic, fundamentally white ethnic, they felt very unwanted in the party. They grew up in the party of Al Smith and Franklin Roosevelt, looking at people like Ally Stevenson, the reform movement snobs, who frowned upon their cultural values. And so they began not only to move out of the Democratic Party, but move out of the city of New York. And so we began to see
a sociological trend, yeah.
Yeah, sociological. You see this in Buffalo, New York, and Syracuse, Rochester, and Scranton, Pennsylvania. The old inner-city blue-collar who worked in manufacturing jobs. The manufacturing jobs tended to start to disappear. They began to lose the culture battles. We fought, we defeated the gay rights bill at New York City Hall 12 times with the help of the Archbishop of New York. Finally, it went down in Connor's time, but the demographics so changed, you just couldn't win anymore. Mm-hmm. So you're right. There had to be a restructuring. And each Archbishop O'Connor, then Egan, and then Dolan, each had to begin closing some parishes, closing schools. There's a huge drop in the population of the schools because, it was now unaffordable for lots of people. Mm-hmm. Now, when I graduated from Monsignor McClancy High School in 1970, it was $300 a year tuition. Today, that school is still alive and working, but it's $9,000. And for working class parents, that's a lot of money, even though a lot of parents make that sacrifice because they know their kids are going to come out prepared for college, unlike 70% of the city public school kids in New York who are not prepared for college when they get out of high school. So there's great sacrifice going on, but the demographics change. These old neighborhoods emptied out. You have a new gentrification, but these are lots of them yuppies and, kids who grew up in godless houses that are not going to the local parishes anymore. So we've lost several generations. So it required consolidation, sad to say.
And you mentioned that each archbishop seemed to bring the right talents for the moment. Now, I'm going to go forward to Cardinal O'Connor, who was definitely one of my very favorite, maybe because I studied him in my lifetime and I heard him speak in my lifetime. But he was a fabulously strong orator who really put forth the church's teachings unabashedly. He made no apology for them, and he really demanded of politicians that they live up to their Catholic beliefs. I think he said, clerics do not have the right to divorce politics from the realm of faith and morals. So he really took a bold stand, and I loved him for that.
Well, he started when he took over in early 84. His first his second or third month, he said the following, quote, I don't see how a Catholic in good conscience can vote for an individual expressing himself or herself as favoring abortion. That started, it just took off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the first battles he had with Mario Cuomo, the Geraldine Ferraro, who was nominated vice president, who was a pro-abortion, and supported this group, Catholic for Free Choice. So he was not afraid of taking on all the forces, particularly so-called Catholic politicians, who the premier one was Mario Cuomo, in the public square. He never stood back. He was never afraid. And as I said, when you read the chapter on O'Connor, mm-hmm. and see him with Cuomo, he beats him at every turn. He was brave not only locally but nationally. Remember, when he died,
oh, yeah.
President of the United States, and Mrs. Clinton came, the Vice President of the United States, Governor Bush was then the nominee for the Republican Party, or about to be the nominee. I was at and had a ringside seat at that funeral, and it was amazing to watch when then Cardinal Law, giving the homily, said, one thing, O'Connor was steadfast, was pro-life. And there was a spontaneous standing ovation. Mm-hmm. I'm 6 foot six, and I was only a few, I was in the political section, a few rows behind the president and the governor of New York, and you had to watch all these pro-abortionists. Mrs. Clinton was there with President Clinton. How they sat there not knowing what to do. It was, you know, it was incredible to watch, because you've never seen the pro-abortionists so uncomfortable. They were on our turf now. They wanted to be there.
Yeah.
But it was remarkable, the spontaneity of this whole church standing up with like three rows of people not standing up because they were afraid.
I remember that because I had so much devotion to him and for the stand, the unequivocal stand that he took. But he had this military background, too. He was the admiral, so he knew how to stand his ground.
He absolutely knew, and that was his greatest strength, and I think in some ways his greatest weakness. He, another Catholic historian, late Monsignor Florence Gohalan, pointed out to me, and I spent many hours at Florence Gohalan, I wrote also a history of the Archdiocese many years ago, but he worked for the federal government for 28 years, and he knew how to spend money but didn't know how to raise money and didn't like it. And so while he was out there fighting these battles and doing the right thing, the Archdiocese was going through this change we just described. Revenues were down, parishes were going broke, and he just didn't like to do fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
And so when his successor came in, Cardinal Egan, first of all, to follow O'Connor is a tough act.
That's a tough act to follow for sure.
And
but Egan was Egan was fantastic.
Oh yeah, yeah, but he was low key. He was not out in the public square. He picked his shot. But he inherited a operating deficit of about $25 million a year, debts of $200 million. He closed the minimum number of parishes. He said to me on a number of occasions, George, the Archdiocese of New York is poor, because a majority of the parishes are not self-supporting, but one thing you have in New York is a lot of rich people. So either you have to raise money to keep the churches and schools open, or you have to close the churches.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't. He closed the minimum down. He worked on the inner city scholarship. He raised money to keep those schools open, raised money to keep those parishes open, paid off the debt.
Cardinal Edward Egan was also the pastor during 9/11, which was a very daunting task.
It was. And that very morning, I spent the last 2 years of Egan's life, spent a great deal of time. I knew him for 25 years, but we spent a lot of time together when he was in retirement and going through his life. And actually, the last letter he wrote was to me the morning he died. I have a frame downstairs. I happened to be in Rome at the time and staying inside the Vatican when I got a call from Monsignor Peter Wells, who's been Deputy Secretary of State, to tell me that Egan had died that evening. But Egan, on 9/11, gets a call from Giuliani, can you come down to, there's a problem down in Ground Zero. And I was mm-hmm. the landlord of the World Trade Center, running the Port Authority back in the 90s. So I knew a little bit about this. I knew a little bit about security. I knew everything that was going on down there. So Egan went down as the buildings were falling. Was asked then to go up to St. Vincent's Hospital, where they were bringing, that was the closest hospital, really, where they were bringing up the injured, a lot of bodies being brought up. And so he was working with the dying, with the dead, mm-hmm. with the hospital there. He did a great deal, again, behind the scenes. He wasn't a showman in that sense.
No, he wasn't. But that was the right demeanor for that crisis.
Did his job. I think he did exactly what he was supposed to during that period.
I do, too. No grandstanding. We didn't need any grandstanding. You know, George Marlin, we are coming to an end of our time available to talk to you, and I would love for you to come back because I find these stories absolutely fascinating. And you know what? We haven't even touched on our current Cardinal Dolan, who is the great evangelist. Quickly, very quickly, tell us what gifts he is bringing. Why is he such a popular personality right now?
Well, again, he fits the time. And first of all, Egan left him a place where there were no major issues he had to deal with. There was money in the bank. There were no problems that, say, you had in L.A. and other pre-creditor problems. So he walked into a place that was well-organized, well-running. So he, once again, is walking the fine. He's not O'Connor, but he's not Cook. So he fits the time where his Irish personality works in just putting a fine face on the church after years of crisis. He did the right thing with the Synod in Rome, questioned some of the craziness they were talking about in Rome. He had the Pope come to New York. That was a beautifully executed plan that he put together. So, again, he is a good face for the church in these very changing times, particularly in the post-priest-predator crisis. Yeah. He filled that void and done what he had to do, different than Egan, but Egan left him a place in great shape. That he didn't have to spend as much time on that.
Right.
Go out there and portray the church.
We want it.
A very positive.
We needed a little personality. God has blessed New York City immeasurably with these wonderful men of faith, these great leaders, these great communicators, these men with great vision. So, George Marlin, thank you for being with us today on Call Me Catholic, but mostly thank you for writing this book, Sons of St. Patrick. Everybody, go out and get a copy of it. It will take you through the whole year till you can just devour all these wonderful little morsels. Catholics need to know our history. This is church history, and by studying these men and how they all use their courageous faith, their talents, and in some cases their foibles to shape one of the greatest cities in the world is understanding where we come from as American Catholics. Thank you, George Marlin. God bless you.
Thank you very much.
And happy St. Patrick's Day.
Same to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for sharing all that with us. Isn't that interesting stuff? I just love all New York Catholics. Boy, I you can't take two subjects I could talk more about. Okay, so you know, Jimmy G, I mentioned earlier in the show how my favorite movie of all time is The Quiet Man. It's a fine Irish classic film. My husband and I have always loved old movies. We're big fans of Turner Classic Movie Channel. And this week, Robert Osborne passed away. He was the beloved host of the Turner Classic Movie Channel and always offered such interesting and insightful commentary about each movie. So thank you, Robert Osborne, for the wholesome gift you gave us in classic movie history, and God rest your soul. And speaking of classic movies, EWTN has a terrific in-house resource with all their radio classics. It's called EWTN Radio Classics, appropriately, and it's a collection of all the best episodes from all their radio programming, which, as you can imagine, is just a huge, expansive library of riches. It's all available to you, my friends. It includes teaching and interviews and devotional segments from the vast EWTN archives. You'll find the best of Mother Angelica, all of Mother Angelica's talks, Patrick Madrid, Father Benedict Rochelle, Jeanette Bankovic, and many, many more. You can access them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So if you wake up in the middle of the night and you need a little Mother Angelica to rest your soul, just go to EWTNradio.net and pick out what speaks to you. They're also available on the EWTN app, another great gift from the EWTN team. Okay, to wrap up our tribute to the good St. Patrick in honor of this upcoming feast day, I took my microphone to Holy Family Catholic Elementary School in the Diocese of Orange, and I asked some of the second graders there to tell me what they know about St. Patrick. Let's hear what they say.
Call Me Catholic. We're chatting with Catholics.
I'm looking over the campus at Holy Family School, and I'm going to approach the second grade classroom and talk to the young students about St. Patrick's Day. I'd like to know how much they know about St. Patrick and how they celebrate this fine holiday coming up. Let's see what they have to say.
Was a saint, and a saint feast is on March 17th.
Bingo, absolutely. And what do you do on March 17th to celebrate St. Patrick's Day?
In first grade, you get to make traps for the leprechauns.
Cat's lucky. He's got lucky charms.
St. Patrick was, I think, born in Ireland.
He spent a lot of time in Ireland, but he actually wasn't born in Ireland.
He was a priest.
Well, he was first a little 14-year-old boy who was captured as a slave and taken to Ireland.
Yeah.
Pretty tough, huh?
So didn't he become a priest?
He became a priest and then he became a bishop.
I think that he was very special because no matter what happened, he still listened to God and Jesus and followed them no matter what.
St. Patrick, he drove all the snakes away. By snakes, I mean all the bad people in Ireland.
Thank you. Well, I call bad people snakes, too, so that covers a lot of territory.
St. Patrick in Ireland, he scared all the rattlesnakes went away from the island, and it rains a lot there.
Are you afraid of snakes?
Probably.
Snakes. Why'd it have to be snakes?
There are a lot of legends about St. Patrick, like one time he cleared all the snakes in Ireland, and also...
I notice all the boys like that part of his story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also, one day he gave his, those things that priests wear.
His robes?
Yeah, he let a friend borrow his robes. Here's a fact about Ireland. There are more cows and sheep than there are people.
Wow.
I actually have a couple things.
We'll go forward. We got a lot to learn.
Well, at school, during St. Patrick's Day, we usually wear green with jeans or...
Why do you wear green?
Because that's the color of Ireland.
Yeah, it's very green. Have you been there?
No, but I've seen pictures of it.
Why is it so green, do you think?
It's an island in the ocean, and the water might get into the rocks and go where the plant roots can catch the water and use it for plant food.
And it rains a lot there, too.
So what I've seen on the field, on our field, are they called three-leaf clovers?
Mm-hmm.
Stands for?
Please.
The Father, Son, Holy Spirit.
The Holy Trinity. And that's how he taught all the pagans about the Holy Trinity. He was able to hold up that clover and show them three parts but one clover, right? So that's like the Holy Trinity.
This might be another story, but I think he used to go to church a lot.
Well, he was a priest, you know.
I have a fact about Ireland.
Oh, well, why don't you share it with us?
The color is green because they have a lot of plants there and... I think it's called Emerald Isle.
Very good. That's excellent. Yes, it is called the Emerald Isle. Have you ever been there?
No.
Are you Irish?
No, but I hope to go there soon.
Okay. Well, I'm a little Irish.
That's cool.
He was born somewhere, like in America, I think. Or close on the other right side. Like he was born close to the east side, so he was probably born in Europe. And then some people came over to where he was born, and he got captured.
They were pirates.
And then they went back to Ireland to sell them for slaves to have a lot of money.
Yeah, that's pretty rough life, huh?
Yeah.
But he survived, and he got taken back to his homeland, and then he became a priest. So God was with him all the time. He's always with us, isn't he?
Yes.
St. Patrick was once captured as a slave, and he was in Ireland, and...
Yeah, what did he do as a slave in Ireland, do you know?
I don't remember.
He worked as, harvesting and doing all the bad people's jobs.
I think he took care of sheep, too.
Yeah, and the flag color is green, white, and orange.
Yes, very good.
On St. Patrick's Day, you could see a rainbow, and he gives you these chocolate coins, I think.
Is there a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow?
Yes.
Yeah. Have you ever seen that pot of gold?
No.
I have a fact about St. Patrick.
Okay.
When he was born with the name Me Winsocket.
And how did it change to Patrick?
That was when he became a priest, and he prayed at least 100 times a day.
Wow, that's a lot of prayers, isn't it? I'm going to try to do that.
Something that I do on St. Patrick's Day is sometimes we go to a family or friend's house to go celebrate it with some food and prayers. For this St. Patrick's Day in April, I'm going to Ireland.
You are? Well, isn't that a coincidence? I hope you have a wonderful time and say a lot of prayers to St. Patrick, who will guide your trip over there.
Castle with a little stone, and then you look backwards, you put your head backwards, and then you try to kiss the stone.
Do you know what that stone is called?
No.
It's called the Blarney Stone.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
And if you kiss it, you're going to have the gift of gab, which I think you've already got, so you don't have to worry about that. Oh, we love talking to the wee ones. They're so fun, so bright, so inspiring. Hey, tune in today at 4:30 p.m. Eastern Time for Doug Keck's interview with Raymond Arroyo. He'll be talking on the show Bookmark about his new book, his latest in the Will Wilder series. That's Raymond Arroyo. Hey, do check out our Facebook page, facebook.com/callmecatholic. We got notes and pictures and lots of comments from our listeners, so we want you to join the family. But mostly, we want you to join us again next week, same day, same time, for more good news from our good faith. Until then, I am Peggy Normandin, but you can call me Catholic.
You've been listening to Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normandin, live from the Christ Cathedral campus in Garden Grove, California. Call Me Catholic is a co-production of EWTN Radio and Orange County Catholic Radio. Heard weekly on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.